Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Cheeky Natives. I have a very special guest here today. I know I say this with every single podcast, but all of our guests are very, very special. That's why they're on the Cheeky Natives. But we have the esteemed Ntikeng Muhlele, who is on today's podcast, which we're recording live at the Bridge Books on Commissioner Street. So I just wanted to read Ntikeng's bio, and you'll hear why a little bit later. So his bio says that he was partly raised in Limpopo in Tembisa and attended the University of the Witwatersrand, where he obtained a BA in Dramatic Arts, Publishing Studies, and African Literature. He is the author of four critically acclaimed novels, The Sense of Bliss, Small Things, Rusty Ball, Pleasure, and now Michael K. Pleasure won the 2016 University of Johannesburg Main Prize for South African Writing in English, as well as the 2017 K. Silodeka Memorial Prize at the South African Literary Awards. It has also been longlisted for the International Dublin Literary Award. Michael K. is Muhlele's fifth novel. And with an introduction like that, we can only be so grateful to have you on the Cheeky Natives. Welcome once again, Ntikeng.
Thank you.
So I'm always very curious as to how authors would describe themselves. Like, there's a bio that exists, and I think at the back of every book the blurb exists and we're told about who you are. But how would you describe who Ntikeng Muhlele is?
I'm just a bloke. to be honest, I'm a human being. I'm a South African. I guess I'm a black man of middle age who is fascinated about the arts in their totality. And I'm a husband, father, and a brother and a son to my mother.
Yeah. All right. So, Ntikeng, when I was reading this book, which is Michael K., you spoke in a lot of interviews about some literary influences that you've had. And I'm quite curious as to who your literary influences are before we get into the actual book. Who would you list as your literary influences? And I ask this particularly in light of the foreword that was written to you by Zaytinda, which is amazing. So who would you list as your literary influences?
I'd list all this esteemed panel here. obviously, I would think, or maybe not so obvious, and it needs to be stated, mm-hmm. I am influenced by my contemporaries because they are colleagues. So it would be Owande, it would be Nick Thromo, it would be Zooks, you know. From that point of view, it would be Sue. People that I work with, we dealing with almost the same social context in real time. It is very, very important for me to be able to engage either in conversation or through artworks with my, what I would call my contemporaries. I think the list is very long to list, in similar form, but it's the African literature canon, right? So that is important for context and for identity and expression of self and self-realization, because you know it's not a fluke that all these important books were written on the continent. So that is important primarily. Before I go to your Philip Roths and your James Baldwin's, your Alex Haley's, your Dambuzo, Javier Marie, for instance, JMC himself, and I know that there are issues around there, it's okay. Wole Soyinka, and Toni Morrison, Alice Walker, those kinds of writers, and Saul Bellow, Albert Camus, those kinds of writers.
Is there a book or books that you think have particularly shaped the way that you write? Is there a book that you sit back and you read and you think, I wish I had written that book?
Not necessarily books, strangely. It's music.
Okay.
Yeah. And that reference would be Kind of Blue, the Miles Davis album, Kind of Blue. Because I think of literature, not in an exclusive manner. I think of literature as part of artistic disciplines. So they are not mutually exclusive to me, right? So film, theater, I always say that, music, and books for me, including performance poetry and what have you, I see them as part of a cyclical continuum.
Okay.
Right. So it would be kind of blue because it is a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful album. And if I were to bring it closer to home, it would be Simpiwe Dana, it would be Mam Busimthong, it would be Tandiswa, King Tai's music, because it's important for context and for self-actualization, if I were to call it that. It's okay to admire everything else outside of the immediate context, but I think you need to be rooted to be able to appreciate other things elsewhere in the world.
So the tagline for Abantu Book Fest is reimagining ourselves into existence. And you've spoken a lot about self-actualization and the need for context. Why do you think that self-actualization is... So the question really would be, what do you think is the role of the black writer in South Africa in the reimagining of ourselves into new existence?
I've got a contradictory answer for you.
Okay.
I don't think we should harp too much on black writer.
Mm.
It should be writer, period, first. Mm-hmm. Human being first, period. Black comes in because of systematic exclusions that have happened over time, cultural exploitation, and exploitation on every single level on the black body. So the stance has been able, that of reclaiming that and reprojecting that which is positive within black artistic practice and black life, for that matter. And not everything that is black, from where I sit, is reducible to art.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that black people here and in the diaspora should continue thinking about this imposed otherness on blackness. For me, I just find it extremely irritating. From where I am sitting. Part of what we see, we had a whole movement of literature that was anti-colonial literature. Then we had the post-colonial Africa and elsewhere, including in the diaspora, that formed a whole identity of literary or artistic output based on a defense of self and preservation of self, and a correction of a myriad of prejudices that were aimed at undermining blackness. And when I say blackness, it's black innovation, black thought, black creative output, black cultures, as well as black identities.
I think that's such an interesting point to make about the field of black literature as a whole, right? Toni Morrison often talks about this, how she feels that the works of black writers have been treated as an anthropological study. They're not treated as critical work that is literature, that is art. You know, they're treated as this anthropological study, and there's a gaze that exists in which we look at the works of people who happen to be black but who are also writers. I mean, often if you think about it, we'd never ever say a white writer, you know. By virtue of existence, you assume that you're a writer, you know. It's like a female rapper. So you studied a BA, and you did dramatic arts, you did publishing studies, and you also did African literature. Have you always known that you're going to be a writer?
Yes, I've always known that, even though I didn't know the how of it or how long it would actually take. But I've always known that I'm going to be a writer. First with when I read Things Fall Apart, it made a very deep impression on me how that book was written. and the last line, the pacification of the primitive tribes of the Lower Niger. It took me a while to understand that. But when I did, I just caught on. And I was taught by very intelligent people. You couldn't make a half-baked argument. They would stretch you to breaking point in terms of what proper reading is, what proper reflection is, what problematizing interlinked and divergent philosophical, cultural, anthropological, social tropes entailed. And that was very empowering.
I'm very curious as to what was your family's reaction to you having wanted to be a writer. Often we, I think especially for Africans, there's a, and I always find this funny because I have the career that's one of the African family careers. But you know, African families often think of you having a proper job when you are a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant, or an engineer. And I've found that often we don't have a respect for the arts as being a career. What was your family's reaction to the idea that you wanted to be a writer?
I come from a family of mainly illiterate people, let me put it that way, but very supportive people. They are illiterate in the academic sense of what an education is. But when you look at life, wisdom around life and being in existence, I would put my family right there at the very top. So they embraced the fact that I wanted to write. I had a job then, I still do now. So the support has been very consistent, and they've embraced what I do, and they get very happy every time that a book comes out or a poster is in town or there's coverage in the press. It's a moment of great pride to them. My mother doesn't read, but I read my books to her. Right? I skip all the weird parts diplomatically. Not because of any sense of deception, but because I was raised in a culture where you have to be decent around your parents. That is a given, right? You have to respect the how do I put it, the fundamentals. So there are lines that one does not cross. And the fact that one went to vets and you have the privilege of being a writer and whatever does not mean you forget who you are as a person. And I'll still get the same message to her, but I must be very diplomatic in how I deal with her.
So earlier on, I asked you, I mean, this is your fifth book that you've published, which is an amazing feat considering the publishing industry that we have and all of the connotations that sort of exist around buying of certain writers' books and. And I asked you earlier if there was a moment in which you felt that you had become a writer. And just for the benefit of everybody who's listening to this, because I thought that was such a poignant response that you gave, I'd just like you to repeat that.
I am a very total person, right? If I dropped dead in the next 16 seconds, I would have no regrets. I live my life discreetly, but very fully. But to answer you more directly, I don't look at literature as this is the body of work of what I've created. Yay. I'm not that kind of person. Each project is very, very, very important to me. And I treat it as a complete universe in and of itself. Right? The fact that there are other books that are written by me, it's purely progression. But each world of each book that I create is very unique to me from an experience point of view. So a more short and direct answer is I've always felt that I'm a writer with everything that I've created, even with an SMS for that matter. I think I place the same weight of being and presence and consciousness, even in a WhatsApp that I sent or something, because I don't see why it should be different. Obviously, and in a book, it would be a much more heightened and conscious thing. But I don't think one should just say, now I'm serious, I'm writing a book. And because being an artist and a writer is not a freak accident, it's a state of being for me.
You've described yourself as almost obsessive, you know, in the way in which you go about in writing your books. What does that entail? So really the question is, when you are settling down to write a book that you describe as this total process, what does it involve for you?
It involves forethought, it involves passion, it involves a quest for self-betterment, it involves heightened consciousness about the world around me. May I have said obsessive, yes, maybe I have not broken it down. Obsessive people would look at some fanatical application of energy at a level of intensity, and that's not what I mean. I'm saying obsessive because it is a great responsibility, creating art, and it's a great privilege, creating art. It's not something that you just put out there because you can. I'm saying obsessive from a point of view of necessary care that needs to be put in place so that I don't embarrass my peers wherever I am. They say, that one says he's a writer. Oh, he should have just been a chef or something. You know? I don't know why you want to be counted with us. And there's a lot of competent writers in this country. And you see, I don't have to tell you.
They are in our audience, those of you who are not
here. She was long-listed with me, by the way. She's on the short list now, and I'm rooting for her to kick some butt.
I'm not one for name-dropping or anything, but I do want to let you know that the she that Ntikeng is referring to is Yewande Omototo, who is in the audience today. So if you didn't come today, you've missed out. You're in the presence of a lot of greatness. And I just want to remind everybody who didn't come that they have missed out on being just in the audience of, like you're saying, great contemporaries around you. Earlier on this year, we had Shalja Patel on the show, and we were talking about literature as a form of activism, you know, and how there's been a great criticism of art and of literature, and I guess art as a totality, that art will not solve the world's problems. So yes, it's great that people are putting out work, and it's wonderful that people are writing books and releasing music. But art will not solve the world's problems. You know, STEM is going to do that. And what is your counter as a writer to the concept that literature, as great and as wonderful as it is, that art will not in any meaningful way change the condition of the world? We're taking a short break.
Are you a Caribbean American? Are you looking for a podcast that truly speaks to your culture and identity? Look no further than Carry On Friends, the ultimate destination for all things Caribbean American, hosted by me, Carrie Ann. Dive deep into topics such as culture, heritage, and everyday life through the unique lens of the Caribbean American experience. You'll walk away feeling more connected to your roots. Follow and listen on Apple Podcasts so you'll never miss an episode of Carry On Friends, the Caribbean American experience. Your Caribbean American community awaits.
I strongly disagree with that stance. Because if art were not that important and not changing anything, there would be no bookshops, there would be no museums, there would be no cinemas, there would be no Shakespeare. There would be no poets. There would not have been a Renaissance. There would not be African sculpture, I always say. There would not be African music, classified as world music. I don't know what that is. So it is a partially, at a very granular and meager level, a possible sentiment that art would not solve some problems directly, but art is very important in enriching lives of people, of cultures, of societies, of history, and of heritage. Because if you don't have those themes that I'm speaking to now, then it's a very empty human life. So there is spiritual importance that art brings to societies. There's a social consciousness that art brings to things. And there is cerebral engagement in terms of problems that solve that plague societies, and not only from a point of looking at art in what is it able to solve, we must also look at what art contributes to societies, and it contributes beauty. That is an important thing, to have beauty in society. It promotes how can I put it, over and above beauty, a reflection on those societies to be able to look at themselves. One cannot say that a film like Amistad, for instance, or Roots, or Schindler's List, for instance, or even the really terribly made Cry Freedom, because of just the weighting of the story. Donald Woods versus the supposed main character, Bantabiko, in the thing, that those are not important and that they don't solve. I think it's a lazy statement, and it's reckless, maybe not intended, but I think it demands far greater thought than it's being afforded.
So your first novel was published in 2008, which is 10 years ago. How do you think that the publishing industry has changed in the 10 years that you've experienced since your first novel to now? And I guess the greater question is, there's been a massive conversation that's been had about how, firstly, there's an idea that black readers don't buy books, or black people don't read. But also, secondly, that a lot of people have felt that the publishing industry continues to, in many respects, make it difficult for black writers to be published, for art that's written by black people to receive the sort of attention that it deserves. And how do you respond to those kind of questions?
It's a mouthful. They are difficult questions to deal with. But we must not confuse a plethora of complementary and divergent themes to be wholesome. Because in your questions, there are commercial considerations. Publishers are in business. That's what we must think about. There are policy issues in terms of your arts and culture department, which I believe humbly that a lot needs to be done in terms of promotion and support of the arts and innovation in policy instruments that enable artists to be able to enter the publishing mainstream, for instance. Blacks people don't buy books, that is not true. It's another reckless statement. Black people read. I was taught by black professors. They refer me to a whole lot of other black people who read other white people, who read Chinese people, and have their horizons broadened by Cambodian writers, Argentinian writers, Spanish writers. See where I'm going with this. There is a tendency, which is very unfortunate, to lump a lot of issues that need unpacking into one singular problem, as if it's not. Every problem is multidimensional, as far as I'm concerned. So a publisher might say, I am not going to publish A, B, C, D, and whatever, because I'm working with these strained margins and what have you. How has it changed? I think it's evolving. It still does not pay writers nearly enough for what it takes to be an author. And that is a problem. And it's a problem also at a policy level, right? We have a lot of celebratory jamborees of music and DJs and what have you, which is fine.
Mm.
And I've got nothing against DJs, and I need to just be succinct and clear.
Mm.
But I can assure you that those multiple disciplines need to be coordinated in how they are rewarded and what it takes to actually participate in that in that space. Mm. Having said that, it's important to caution people that writing should not be done only for money motives, but it is important to respect the labor of writers and artists, like everyone else's writer is respected. If I needed an op, it's not going to be cheap. If I went to an
orthodontist.
Orthodontist. I'm wearing braces, as you can see. It's not cheap, but people want freebies from writers. And I, when I put my braces on, just under 2 years ago, they told me it's gonna cost 45,000 rand, and I thought I didn't hear properly, and it turned out to be very true. And I found my medical aid, and I had a 45-minute discussion on why it was not a medical emergency. But you see where I'm going.
And this is a very interesting point that you've just made, and it takes me back to a conversation Zulisa and I had recently, where she spoke about, it's so great to be able to name drop and have the people in the audience. I just want to put that out there. It's really great to be like, oh, I was out with Zulisa. And I guess that's a, just as an aside, that's a large sort of change, I think, that the Chief Nurses is able to appreciate. I don't know if 15 years ago, you know, people who looked like me. And so Zuyiswa recounts being in, it was in Lviv, where they have a writer on the currency. And just that has stuck with me forever, that they have a writer on the currency, that they are so respectful and so appreciative of the art of writing, that they have... they had a writer on the currency. They had places named. They had a university named after a writer. You couldn't go anywhere without seeing busts of writers and of people who've contributed to the literature in the Ukraine. And for me, it's always so sad to hear great South African writers who are recognized by people outside of South Africa, you know, receiving all of this credit and acclaim, and the realization that we don't place that same amount of respect for literature in this country. And I'm curious as to when you say that you believe that we need to pay more respect to writers, and we need to give more support to writers, what does that look like for you?
Well, there are millions and millions of rands that get allocated to departments, right? You cannot look at an education system, in my view. I am not a policymaker. I am not a president. I'm an artist. But I don't think you can look at an education revival and development of an education system away from an important discipline like literature and writing, for instance. There is a lot of writer residencies that get offered from other localities around the world to South African writers. People have to go freeze in some snow in some foreign country somewhere, and yet they pay taxes, right? They pay taxes, and the moment Zukiswa or Sue, you know, and Yowande wins the Nobel Prize one day, and that's when you'd see them in broadsheets that, oh, these people are important. They'll be on every television show, when and that and that.
And we will refuse to appear on those shows.
And it's sad. And I'm not saying this out of protest or mm-hmm. of defiance. It's just decency and common sense from where I sit, because I don't believe that there is not money in the fiscus, right? I don't want to get into the Gupta issues, because just on that alone, I don't know how many writers you can empower.
And I think, as somebody who's not a writer, I think particularly for me, over and over again, I see the importance of having a population that is literate and well-read, you know. And it goes beyond the idea that it's nice for people to read books, but there is something that reading empowers you with as a person that extends into so many other aspects of your life that completely changes how you behave almost in certain ways. So we talk about how certain books will have an impression on you. I remember reading Things Fall Apart, and that for me was like the first education. Like, wait, actually things haven't always been like that. And that probed a deeper interest into an understanding of other issues. And I think it's always very interesting for me to hear authors continuously lament the same things. And I think that it's an indictment on us just as a society that even in 2018, like, extremely talented writers in this country are still not receiving the support that they need. And it does call for an innovation and an innovative way for us to look at publishing and at writing and at reading in this country. So I'm actually also just very curious about the books. You've mentioned a lot of like literary influences and books that you've read that have a deep impression on you. So I guess my question is, and I always ask our guests this, that if you had a 16-year-old that you wanted to recommend five books to, that you wanted them to read these five books, and you felt that these five books would set them well on the path in life, what five books would you recommend this young 16-year-old to read, and why would you recommend those books?
I would give them a difficult assignment. Mm-hmm. I would say I've got five books that I want to recommend to you. Mm-hmm. But before I do that recommendation, go read all the work of every contemporary South African writer working today. Mm. Make sure that you know it back to front. Once you have done that, I know that the home base is covered. Mm-hmm. Then
what a task for a 16-year-old. Yeah,
then I would say read Things Fall Apart. Mm-hmm. Then read Detained. Mm-hmm. I would say read. It's a difficult one. I would say read Kaffir Boy. Mm. Mark Matabani. Mm. I'd say read the poetry of Gurapets, Khosetsile, Prof. Khosetsile, and read it over a lifetime. Mm. Not read it and put it aside. Read it, revisit it for as long as you have time and a mind and eyes to be able to read. Mm. Right? I would say read Mara Chera. Mm. Mm. And I would say Mara Chera as a theme, which means you won't read House of Hunger or Mind Blast or, you know, Black Sunlight and the poetry or the interviews, including the self-interview, right? So from that point of view, I would say that is very, very, very important.
Mm-hmm. And by that time they won't be able to pass metric because they've been so focused on doing it.
By that time they are no longer 16. I mean, just reading all of Tambuzo and whatever. So I actually wanted to now get into Michael Kay, which is your latest book. Firstly, congratulations on the amazing launch on Thursday. Social media was alight. Everybody was just tweeting. It was amazing to see the kind of reception that you've had. And I'm actually just very curious about that. That do you five books, and do you still get overwhelmed by having that kind of reception? Or, I mean, as somebody who's always imagined themselves as a writer, are you almost expectant of that, considering the kind of labor and the work that you put into your books?
I'm going to take 4 steps back.
Okay.
To answer your question.
Okay.
I am not overwhelmed by the responses that I get for the work that I do. And I know that at face value that might seem like a cocky answer or an arrogant answer. It's not intended to be like that. I am extremely confident in what I do as a person. There is no reason that surpasses all the stars that adorn the heavens why I should not be confident in what I do. Because people have been killed over centuries just for the right to exist as whole human beings. If you read 491, for instance, Mom Winnie's story, there would be absolutely no reason for there to not be total faith and total appreciation of the privilege. It's a great privilege to be able to write and to create, because too many unacceptable prices have been paid by people here in this country and on the wider continent. And it would be, for me, very futile for any young person in South Africa or on the continent to feel that there is even the slightest dash of inferiority in the life paths that they set for themselves. So it is something that I am very conscious of, and I only try my very best to do to write the best work that I can write, but that is not sufficient. I have to also believe in the thing that I do, because then people have to pick up from where I left off when the book leaves my desk and it's in shops and what have you. I don't think, and this would sound a bit extreme, that anyone has got a right in this country and elsewhere to walk around with slumped shoulders and a bowed head for nobody. And for that, I mean it, and I actually even take it personal. If someone expects me to justify what I do, I don't. I don't. And for someone who might read it as cocky, my suggestion would say, please go inspect the history of South Africa and how we got where we are, and the history of the world, and exploitation everywhere else where there are human beings.
So, with regards to Michael Kay, so the blurb says that this work was written in response to J.M. Coetzee's classic masterpiece, Life and Times of Michael Kay. Ntike Mohlele dabbles in the artistic and speculative in a unique attempt to unpack the dazed and disconnected world of the title character, his solitary ways, his inventiveness, but also to show how astutely Michael Kay holds up a mirror to those whose paths he inadvertently crosses. Michael Kay explores the weight of history and of conscience, thus wrestling the character from the confines of literary creation to the frontiers of artistic timelessness. Zeif Sunda, in writing about this book, said that this is a work of reflective intensity, reimagining a memorable character from J.M. Coetzee's world of stark and sparse prose and transplanting him into Mohlele's ornate and lyrical one. So you were asked recently as to whether you were not nervous about writing about this book, which has such a massive literary following and reimagining it. And you were asked in an interview recently whether you felt any sort of pressure, you know, from J.M. Coetzee's fans or fans of the book in writing this book. And I think that you've answered that question quite succinctly in the preceding answer. So what I do actually want to talk about is the book itself. Firstly, the writing in this book is absolutely amazing. This is such a beautifully written book.
Okay.
Eusebius, who I feel like stole my words, but he actually didn't because he said them first, described your writing as being lyrical without being ethereal. And I think that is absolutely the best way to sort of describe the way in which you've written this book. I think that anybody who's reading the book is transported to Dust Island, to Johannesburg. You're sipping the coffee, you're laughing at Professor von Rundberg, and that is just a testament to the absolute work that you've put into crafting what is an amazing response. There are a lot of themes that you explore in the book, and I actually just wanted to expand on them. So death is a theme that comes up often in the book, and I'm curious as to why you wanted death to be one of sort of the focal themes of this book. Was this a commentary on your own feelings about death, about also illness and I guess mortality as a whole?
I read a lot of existential philosophy. Or philosophy in general.
Mm.
And I like the way it illuminates different aspects of the life continuum. And I think it was Camus who said something about suicide as the ultimate, I don't remember the exact phrasing of it, but it's to the effect that, self, power of self, in what to do with your own life must be like the ultimate, expression of self. Health is part of being, and I don't refer here only to bodily health, but also spiritual health. And those are themes that I come to because the world is premised on life, but on death too. The reason that you've got the Security Council is precisely because countries have industrialized death. And that is why in geopolitics and in international relations, there is so many issues and discussions around nuclear proliferation. For instance, that is a death factory. The fact that it's not operating doesn't mean it's not there. Some dumb person just needs to push a button and wipe out people. It's the burden of disease in countries and whether they have the wherewithal to be able to actually protect citizens and what have you. It's also a death of ideas, and dictatorships around the world is a certain level of death as far as I am concerned. But I'm saying, like light and darkness, life and death coexist as important themes in life. For other people, it takes different manifestations. For people that are very religious, the death of Christ is an important marker. And he has risen is another important mark there. So it's from that point of view that I engage with these things.
Illness also makes an appearance as a focal theme in this book. And there's a scene which prompted me to wonder about your own feelings about euthanasia and your feelings around people determining the course of their own illnesses. Have you grappled with that sort of as a theme in your own personal life? I'm curious as to why this came up so profoundly in this book, especially.
It's a difficult one to answer. Have there been personal sentiments of ill health in my own personal life? I'm going to sidestep that question for reasons that are personal rather than, artistic.
Mm.
But as an artist, I have witnessed a lot of suffering.
Mm.
brought about in part by people being unwell. Mm. Have I had near-death experiences? Yes, I have. But I'll just not go into details. And I think that, to be fair, it would be disingenuous to say portions of personal experiences do not, in some backdoor kind of way, or in small sentiment ways, make it into the art that one creates. But whether I want to illuminate that freely is another story altogether.
There's a passage that I'd... Yeah. I think everyone wants you to read from this passage. because you might not... you might just not look at a certain food stuff the same. having read from this... From this passage, I just need to... I think you know the passage that I'm talking about.
I have no idea.
Suki knows the page number.
That I'm talking about. So I just wanted to make to prelude before we read. On a lighter note, I think that everybody is going to be asking us again to read from this passage because you, like I'm saying, it speaks to the kind of writing that you can expect to find in this book. But it also just speaks to the way in which you make looking at what might be just a mundane, you know, ordinary day of everyday thing not necessarily appear that way. So I'd just like to ask that you please read from page 80 for the benefit of our readers, who of course will go out and buy the book.
My wife is going to listen to this podcast, you know.
This is a content warning for Tiking's wife. She can just skip over this part.
Okay, from where?
So I'd just like you to read from here, please. So from this last part, okay. Just to him.
Okay. I will read this famous passage that seems to be overshadowing this book.
Not overshadowing, illuminating okay. The book.
All right, let's say that seems to illuminate part of this book. Okay. She is a child, man. Besides, our relationship is strictly professional. Although this, of course, was not strictly true, I so desired Maureen that I at times temporarily lost my mind, any sense of restraint, that I imagined with a sudden swell of emotions and enlightenment how desperately I craved Greek salad, cucumbers, lettuce, onion rings, and baby tomatoes, only dressed with her springs, her womanly eruptions resultant from our imagined carnal sieges. I, on occasions, at obscure restaurants, still order Greek salad for its erotic rather than dietary qualities. And when salad dressings are presented as options, wish Maureen was around to squat over the bowl, let loose her precious leeks, that I would pounce on her and show her that the devil existed. And when she moaned and fluttered, regained my composure by feasting on my salad, she would have been too kind to irrigate. What would be profounder? What could be profounder than that? When I literally and figuratively ate her, ingested her mysterious waters, and then used her panties as a napkin.
After reading a passage like that, how can Greek salad ever look the same to you again? So love is also a theme that comes up often in this book. But I found it interesting the way that you portrayed the romantic relationships. I'm particularly interested in the relationship between Boitumelo and Prof. Von Ludwig, which is both passionate but also sometimes a little bit distant. Can you just expand on the theme of love in relation to this book?
Mm-hmm. I think it's an ancient orchestration of the love theme. Mm. It's Romeo and Juliet in another light, really. You know, and from where I'm sitting, if you looked at relationships that are perfect, they are nice to admire. Mm. But literature is drama. Story is drama. Mm. And it's when the sparks fly and when things go wrong, when there's a loss of equilibrium, that art becomes interesting, at least for me, from how I see it. And so perfectly drawn characters and the scenarios that they live in is not necessarily interesting for me, because then it's lacking in the charge that make human beings imperfect, an imperfect species, as it were. And because human beings have got different yearnings, even if they're united by like-minded pursuits, like romantic engagements.
So with regards to the character developments in the book, so Michael M is, he's the title character, but he in effect makes a cameo appearance in the book. I mean, so in the first part of the book, without giving away too much, because we want everyone who's just heard of page 80 to go and buy the rest of the book. He makes an appearance in the beginning of the book, but then the book goes on to be narrated by Miles M. And there were a lot of jazz sort of references in the book, and I was while reading the book, I was actually wondering if the title character was you paying homage to Miles Davis, or is it just an interesting literary coincidence that the title character is named Miles M?
Miles M is my son. Mm. I named him after Miles Davis because I love the music of Miles Davis. Mm. And so progressive are my parents that they universally said, go ahead, he's your child, which was lit. I like that, and I love that about them. And so, yeah, I think that's a personal... I think so.
Professor von Ludwig is a very interesting character. He's this professor of philosophy who holds some very interesting views about a variety of topics, and poetry is one of the topics that he often goes into in-depth characterization on. And poetry often makes an appearance in this book over and over again, which just had me wondering if there's an anthology somewhere inside of you.
I write poetry informally. Mm. I read a lot of poetry. But poetry is music. I love music, and I listen to a lot of music as well. So I think it embellishes sensory worlds, as it were. Would I have a poetry anthology one day? Too soon to tell. We'll see.
We'll see. Okay, I can take that. Stay tuned.
Yeah.
So, philosophy, you've spoken about the fact that you read a lot of existential philosophy. Was making Professor von Ludwig a professor of philosophy a nod to that era of your life? I think he could have been a professor of anything. I just found it particularly interesting in this context, having read the book, that he was a professor of philosophy. And often says the most poetic things in the book, as opposed to Miles M, who is sitting with this inner poet that we have yet to see. Professor von Ludwig often says very poetic things, despite the fact that he's a professor of philosophy.
Yeah, okay. I think that literature and philosophy are siblings from where I'm sitting.
Mm.
Gustav von Ludwig, the character in Michael Kay, has very much grown around real-life poets.
Mm.
So he understands sensibilities that define the life of poets. And yet his passion is actually philosophy. Philosophy, I think, is a narrative device as well to be able to unpack ideas that... would have been heavy was it not actually orchestrated in such a way that you had a philosopher presenting that, those ideas. If you want effective, quiet, discreet fighting of a war, army generals deploy snipers. So von Ludwig is my sniper in the book, because there's no machine gun fire per se, but I think that he's effective.
He is. So Miles M, who's narrating the story, settles in Johannesburg. And so location in this book is very interesting. We move from being in Dust Island to being in Johannesburg, and even when we're in Johannesburg, there are very different locations that are described. And I'm curious, I mean, so he could have moved anywhere to become, to find his inner poet, you know? And I mean, why did you particularly choose him to come to Joburg? I think that often when we think of Joburg, you think of this place where people come to make their dreams come true. Joburg is for the hustle, it's where you make things happen. Miles M moves to Joburg to find his inner poet. And that's just a very interesting sort of choice of location for me.
Yes, because there's a lot of energy to the city. And there is a historic significance to the city as well. And I think that things happen in Johannesburg because it is what it is. So I don't think there's any complicated metaphoric interpretations of signifier and signifieds and this and that. Joburg is just cool. That's it.
So Miles then comes to Joburg because he wants to pursue this passion, but without giving away too much of the plot, the passion sort of doesn't come to pass, you know. But what is interesting is the fact that Miles M is also a government employee. And in a prior interview that you had, you said that one of the themes that you wanted to explore was corruption and civil servants and that sort of interplay. And I'm curious as to whether this was you making a commentary on, I mean, he goes on to describe them as almost as two-legged animals. He says that they're two-legged animals, and some of them have fur. I mean, and that imagery is...
And tails.
That imagery is powerful, you know. Fur and tails in describing is a certain sector of governance.
Well, thank you. I it must be said, there are very rotten sections of our society. Mm. Period. Mm. And I don't think that any artist worth their salt that is going to tiptoe around that. Is I don't know how I would relate to such an artist. There are rotten things in our country, right? Very rotten things. And having said that, there are rotten things everywhere in the world, right? But I thought that as a South African, an African, a country south of the African continent, I would witness these things and write about them. And actually, Nick Nkroma does it extremely well in Way Back Home, in a much more exhaustive way, because he goes through every labyrinth that is there in terms of just the state of affairs of post-independence governance in South Africa. But not only that, he actually even takes that through from exile and how you have sub-communities within a society and the nature, evolution and mutation of privilege. So I would strongly recommend Way Back Home for this thing, which he does it much better than and in a much more comprehensive way. You see what I meant about contemporaries?
So Miles M has a lot of curiosity about Michael K, and this is a curiosity that sort of extends throughout the book. I mean, people are curious about the simplicity of his life and how he lives the way that he has, you know, and it continues with the theme. And for me, I think people have often been accused of having a curiosity about the lived experiences of other people, particularly Black people, in a way that almost reduces their lived experiences. How would you sort of respond to that curiosity of the characters about Michael K, where he comes from, who he is, why is he this person that lives this solitary lifestyle? What is there an entitlement that the community has to Michael K's story, his life? I mean, he often gets asked, what does the K in your name stand for? And for me, that was just interesting over and over again, that there were people who were so invested in knowing about other people's lived experiences that you'd even want to write they'd want to write a book about him, you know, in the story as it continues. And there's all of this interest around that particular character.
I think Michael K is a representative of the unsaid. Mm. And the misunderstood. Mm. He functions primarily as a very metaphorical character from where I am sitting. Mm. But it also speaks to a very silent thing, which is the interdependence between generations of thinkers and writers. Just as an aside, I've been told I don't know how many times that, my God, you've got balls. So I have to keep checking if they're still there or if they've changed from how I know them to be. And I don't see what the balls are about. Mm. And here, just to perhaps clarify for listeners, it's guts, really. Mm. It's metaphorically that you've got guts that you would approach this very, you know, esteemed, famous, accomplished work of art. But like I've said earlier in the interview, I think that societies are entitled to interacting with the artistic output of their scribes in their totality. What connections they make should not really be of concern for writers. Writing is too much work as it is. Now, to belabor complex explanations and what have you, I think that is not ideal, at least speaking for myself.
Speaking of the guts that you've been asked if you have, I think that it's come up in numerous interviews that, you know, people have been asking about about the bravado it must take, or the confidence that they think it must take on a literary subject like the life and times of Michael K. But you mentioned that you'd read the book numerous times over 30 times over a 15-year period. And I'm curious as to why you kept going back to the life and times of Michael K. You have read quite widely and extensively, and have mentioned numerous books that have an impact on you as a writer and a reader. But why was it so profound to go back over and over again to the life and times of Michael K.? And I guess leading into that, you've mentioned that you have an interest in the reimagining of certain narratives. So you mentioned how you, in an earlier interview, how you were fascinated by the works of somebody like Thando Mnumzana in writing Unimportance, for example. You know, so it could have been any book. So the question is twofold. It's related to the life and times of Michael K, but also why this particular sort of genre interests you.
I shouldn't say too much, but I am not finished in terms of my interests. I would not necessarily write a sequel to another book and what have you, but I think that it is important to know what you are doing. So I don't think there's any profound answer to that. If you're going to be dealing with an important task. I think a surgeon, for instance, if a patient needs to go for surgery, there is a pre-assessment of whether the patient is fit to undergo surgery, and the counterweighing of risk, right? And it's a very specialized thing to do. And that is why some surgeries take 12 hours mm. to do. I don't think it's any different from someone who is writing a book. Mm. It's just that it happens that it's words and ideas. And I think that long period of gestation of reading and whatever is not only particular to Michael Kay. It's with literature that I enjoy, you know, that I keep going back to and reading. Because it would be extremely embarrassing if I didn't need to talk about my own work. Mm. Someone said, comment on Zukiswa's work or Yawande's work. Mm. We've got 5 minutes. The person who was supposed to be here is not here. Mm. What are your views on ABCD? Mm. It would not be fair to have read it only once. Mm. It's proper to read it and internalize it and understand it. Because I might, whether planned or unplanned, need to be an advocate for that particular book, as my peers and colleagues do the same for me.
So I like to ask authors how, because the blurb is somebody else's description of your book. I like to ask authors often how they would describe their book to a stranger. So you meet somebody on the Gau train and you get talking and they say, oh, what do you do? Which is a favorite question in this wonderful city of ours. And you respond, I'm a writer. And they say, oh, what is your latest... Oh, what is your real job? What do you do on the side? You know, I mean... So I didn't ask you about your hobbies. I mean, what's your real job? But on a serious note, how would you describe this book to a stranger? So how would you describe Michael Kay to a stranger?
As a lightning bolt. That's how I would describe
it. As a lightning bolt. Nice. It's probably the best description I've heard of an author describing a lightning bolt with a side serving of Greek salad. You have to read the book to get the reference. I love that description that you describe your book as a lightning bolt. And I actually want to just say a very, very big thank you to Tigeng for coming out on a Saturday morning and being a part of the Cheeky Natives. I think a massive part of what the Cheeky Natives does is the archiving of literature by people who look like us, for us, and the reimagining of what the literature is, right? What the narrative is. And it's every time that we have this podcast, it just reinforces that we're doing the things, we're making the parts, we're bringing it together. And it's just so powerful to have taken on what would have a lot of authors would have shied away from, you know, reimagining or putting your own, writing your own book, which does stand on its own two legs as its own book, of what was a Booker Prize winning work, you know. And having read Michael Kay, I just want to implore everybody to go out and not only read Michael Kay, but also to read Pleasure, to read Rusty Ball, Small Things, to read The Sense of Bliss for the appreciation of what is an amazingly talented writer. I think that the fact that your contemporaries are in the audience and nodding, just a few seconds away from snapping as we speak, is testament to the ways in which you are incredibly talented and how seriously you take your art. So I just want to say a very, very big thank you to you, Tsikeng. It's been absolutely wonderful having you on the podcast. I want to encourage everybody to go out and not only buy Michael Kay, but also buy all of his other works as mentioned. Like we said earlier, Pleasure was longlisted for the International Dublin Literary Award. I mean, it's won numerous awards as well. So we just want to encourage everybody to go out and read the works of Tsikeng Muhlele, and also do the homework that was prescribed. He dropped a lot of amazing names and a lot of amazing literary recommendations, enough to keep a 16-year-old busy until the end of high school. And so we just want to thank you once again. We look forward to seeing more of your work and seeing more of you. And we just can't wait to see what the future has in store for you.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. And I like the name Cheeky Natives. I think it's very innovative. But thanks for inviting me. It's been a great pleasure. And I have learned a great deal from engaging with you.
Thank you.
And I'm very privileged that my peers.
So you deserve land.
We're getting this.
Okay.
So the Cheeky Natives, as reminded by a wonderful guest who got her own piece of land, that's why she's reminding us about this. We have a very interesting rating system. We don't give our authors popcorn and stars. What must you do with popcorn and stars, you know? What we do as the land committee at the Cheeky Natives, which is chaired by myself and Nitlokonolo, who is currently in the US pursuing his master's, we give land to our guests based on how much we've enjoyed their books, you know, and based on things that we've read in the story and. So based on how much we've just enjoyed reading Michael Kay and your previous works and the amazing work that you've done, as chairperson of the land committee at the Cheeky Natives, I would just like to give you a piece of land in Melrose Arch. And when you read the book, Melrose Arch features in the book, you know. So I just think it's only fitting that with you having paid homage to Melrose Arch, that as chairperson of the land committee, we give you a piece of land in Melrose Arch for you to go on to pursue your literary interests. We can see it happening, you know, in Melrose Arch.
That is wonderful. Coincidentally, I was at Melrose Arch yesterday, going to buy food for my baby, for my daughter. So now the landlord cometh to Melrose Arch, and Julius, yeah, we might need to talk.
You won't even have to speak to Julius. We've spoken about this. It's organized.
It's
organized.
Yeah.
It's sorted.
The Cheeky Natives have said it.
The Cheeky Natives have declared it.
No,
so it is so.
No, I wanted to tell him the rules from the landlord going forward.
So we cannot wait as the land committee to apportion this piece of land. So you are more than welcome to rename it. We would love it if you did. It's okay if you choose not to. But from here on, Melrose Arch is now officially owned by Ntsike Mhlele. So
title deed, people.
Thank you.
Thank you.